So to stretch the lecture a little bit today, so, you know, if you get, like, really hungry and bored, it's not my fault. I'm just fulfilling my duty to earn back my reimbursement. Because, you know, lunges have won it anyway, and they were worried they would start rioting and stuff like that. So. All right. So I was asked to give some introduction to flux compactifications. I will do so. And the lectures will consist basically of three parts of unequal length. No. So, in the first part, I'll just give the general idea of moduli stabilization and the importance that flux vacua have played in that important goal. So, this will be just sketch of the general idea without getting into any really concrete realizations of it in string theory, as well as the challenges which occur generally in the endeavor of moduli stabilization problems, which were known for a long time and thought to be pretty much intractable up to the advent of flux vacua. Okay. Then I'll get to the description of some explicit models in type 2B, or if you want, like the most unified framework to describe those things is F theory, even though I will mainly confine myself to type 2B language. And then in the third part, which will be somewhat shorter probably, I'll explain some strategies to cope with the landscape, the string theory landscape that came out all of it, of all that came out of it. Okay. Okay, so that's the plan. So today I will talk about one and part of two. Okay. So one, moduli stabilization, flux vacua. Okay, you can see it there. Maybe I can just erase it. It's probably the most efficient. There we go. Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, it's one of
the. You get a bonus.
You get a bonus, that's right, that's right. You mean because of. No, in fact. Well, this is all recorded, so I will never. Further comments. Good question. Okay. So what is the general idea of most scenarios of stabilizing moduli, or what are moduli in the first place? What should we do with them? So okay, the basic setup of any string compactification is so you start with some supersymmetric, well, preferably n equals 1 supersymmetric string compactification, right? On some 6 manifold X, right? So times, flat R13. Okay, so we have a box here which symbolizes flat R13. And at every point, we have the internal manifold, six-dimensional, which, because of the requirement of supersymmetry, must satisfy some rather stringent geometrical constraints. And examples of this, or which constraints these are, depends on what description of string theory you're using. So for example, this could be type 2, A or B, on Calabi-Yau tree, or antifolds. This could be the heterotic on some ordinary Calabi-Yau tree folds. This could be M-theory on G2 manifolds, F-theory on some elliptically private Calabi-Yau 4 folds. That's pretty much the main examples. So all of these lead to N equals 1 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. Yeah. Okay. That's great. So we can nicely describe all these spaces at various 3D properties. However, there's one big problem with them, and that is they always come with moduli. Always moduli. Okay. So what are moduli? Moduli are deformations of this internal geometry, the various fields living on this internal geometry, at which you can do at no cost in energy. Okay. So these are deformations of compactification, continuous deformations. At no cost in energy. Okay. And as a result, since you can think of these deformations being parameterized by scalars, these give rise then to massless scalars in 4 dimensions. Okay. So these are moduli. So examples of such moduli, I guess, an almost exhaustive list. Well, in string theory, you will always have, in such compactifications, the dilaton. Which is a string coupling constant, but it can vary over space. Then there are so-called Kähler moduli. These are nothing but size moduli. Okay, so they are basically things that scale up sizes. For example, the volume. Okay, for any geometric compactification of these kinds, the flat R13, you will always have a volume modulus, basically, at least classically, right? So this is all. This is all classically at tree level. Yeah. So you always have this volume modulus basically because of the scaling variance of the Einstein equations or the supergravity equations. Then, in general, there can be many more individual sizes of non-trivial cycles in the manifold. There are complex, so-called complex structure moduli. Okay, so these guys appear in the presence of, in the case of Calabi-Yau complex cases. Complex structure moduli. So these are shape moduli, if you want. Okay. So the simplest example of that is the case of T2, say, right? So there, complex structure moduli corresponds. The complex structure modulus corresponds to this number tau, which parameterizes the tilt of the torx. Yeah. And then there are, if you put D-brains in this compactification, which in general you have to cancel tadpoles and so on. So in type 2, you get D-brain moduli, and heterotic gets more general non-abelian bundle moduli. Right, so these are, well, okay, taking this trivial case of T2 again, Actually, maybe I should think of this as C2 times C2 times C2. Right? So in that case, you could put like some brain like this, but then you can translate this brain to there at no cost in energy, obviously. Any more complicated geometries, you could also have like deformations from this to that or whatever. You know. There's a whole set of possibilities here. And in fact, in type 2 compactifications, this will usually dominate the number of moduli. Okay? So these are all, well, these are geometric moduli. This is, well, if you lift this to M theory, this is actually also geometric modulus. And then there is a whole set of non-geometric moduli, if you want, which appear typically as scalar superpartners of these scalars, and those are the axions. Okay? So, for example, this could be the Wilson line of some gauge field, right? So if you have some path gamma, there's like some gauge fields A living on, let's say U1 gauge field living on this torus or something, right? And integral over this loop of A gives you a scalar, which is an axion, which will appear as an axion in four dimensions. And this generalizes to other fields. So, for example, the two-form NSNS potential of string theory integrated over some two-cycle and non-trivial two-cycle will give you an axion. And that has like various RR potentials integrated over some non-trivial p-cycle. Right? These are periods of these things. Where you take these fields in each case to be flat, right? So they don't have any energy, but nevertheless, there's more than just one possible choice of that field. So these give axions. Sorry? Oh, yeah. So that there's, of course, various ways that they can. So the axion, for example, can be eaten up by some Green-Schwarz mechanism and those things. But oh, these are, yeah. So this is all everything is classically here at this point. Yeah. Okay. And even though in textbook examples, the number of moduli is often, you know, maybe like 10, 20, 30 or something, that is, of course, some anthropic selection effect because people like to deal with simple models. If you look at, you know, more generic models that you could cook up, you can easily get thousands and thousands of moduli. So that's a lot of moduli, but okay. The problem is that moduli are bad. Okay, there are many reasons why they're bad, but I'll more or less take it as a starting point for this lecture and leave detailed discussions about how bad they are at the classical level to people that are more competent than me in those things. But of course, well, definitely if there's nothing that lifts them, right, if they remain exactly massless, and they have, like, you know, the ordinary, maybe gravitational strength couplings, the way they appear in string theory, then you would measure them, okay? There would be extra long-range forces apart from the ones that we observe, right? So that would be, like, some sort of beyond gravity, some additional attractive force. And, well, that's just not there, at least. It's not observed, so that would mean if such scalars are there, they would ridiculously weakly couple to everything we know, and there's no natural way to do that. Okay. So then, in general, I mean, even if they get some potential due to supersymmetry breaking or something like that, is that they screw up basically, well, everything you know and love about standard model of cosmology. So they can screw it up in violent ways, but even if you start tuning things and try to avoid it, maybe given madness in a way or another, you often run into the problem that nuclear synthesis, the successful predictions of nuclear synthesis and so on, in the absence of such light scalars, well, definitely screwed up. So. Okay, and moreover, at the more theoretical level, is that they tend to destabilize vacuum after breaking supersymmetry. Okay. So, well, the reason that these scalars are here at the massless scalar at the classical level is, well, for a large part, is supersymmetry. Right? Once you break supersymmetry, then generically, well, there's just nothing that will protect scalars from acquiring masses from various quantum effects. So you expect that also they won't. So you say, well, okay, big deal. So I just break supersymmetry and everything is fine again. But then the problem is, if you try to do that in a controlled way, well, you run into difficulties. You typically get runaway. So if you before supersymmetry breaking, say, you have some nice flat potential. So phi, you know, collectively these massive scalars, right? It's moduli. D of phi is flat after supersymmetry breaking. This might become something. This, maybe, that. Okay. So either way, you get like some runaway direction, and what you thought was some nice controlled convectification actually is not. Okay. Well, there's much more to be said about that, but that's not what I want to spend time on. Let's just take as our starting axiom that, well, moduli are bad, and we want to get rid of them as much as we can. Okay. So I already alluded to it here, and in reply to a question. So this is all classically, and indeed, quantum corrections, even at the supersymmetric level, due to non-perturbative effects, supersymmetric level. So quantum corrections can lift moduli. Okay. These can be instanton effects, more down-to-earth perturbative effects. So for example, here's our original flat potential. Okay. So even supersymmetrically, it may get lifted, and so you might imagine, okay, for as long as you're working supersymmetrically, you only get negative values of the energy at any critical point of the effective potential. But you could imagine something like this, right? Critical point. Okay. And that would solve the problem, basically. I mean, these moduli are stabilized, and then you can sort of try to break supersymmetry in a controlled way without having to worry about these moduli. So you would think, okay, fine. However, here, and this is sort of the problem that plagued, you know, all attempts in string theory up to relatively recently. So the problem is control. Yeah. And in fact, it remains a problem in many of present-day attempts and stabilizing moduli. But so what's the general thing? Well, see, on very general grounds, it is unfortunately true that whatever quantum corrections, or whenever any kind of corrections in some conservative theories or anything, are important, well, you cannot compute them, and whenever you can compute them, they're not important. Okay. In string theory, it's even worse often, namely, whenever you can compute them, they lead to runaways. Okay. So concretely, so say rho is some modulus, okay, which will serve as some control parameter and some expansion where subsequent corrections are suppressed by powers of 1 over rho or even the minus rho. Anyway, like some modulus such that sort of zero coupling, or if you want classical limits, right? So the limit in which you have full control, and the limit in which you can trust the classical geometry, and so on. So let's say that corresponds to rho to infinity, okay? So this could, for example, be rho equals volume, or rho maybe, so the volume of the convectification manifold, or maybe of some cycles, but let's say convectification manifold, or maybe e to the volume, or 1 over g string, you know, okay, something like that. Well, so then, since by assumption, right, this assumption, we have that V goes to zero when rho goes to infinity, okay, because that's where you recover the classical geometry, and in that limit we have just exactly flat directions, we have moduli, okay. So that means that, so the first correction, right, say you do a lot of work, you compute the first correction. Well, okay, so first correction will look something like maybe 1 over rho, right? If you choose a parameterization suitably, you can assume it to be 1 over rho. So then, okay, well, 1 over rho, maybe minus 1 over rho. But either one of these cases is trouble. Okay, in the case it's 1 over rho, then you get this runaway, right? So if that's all there is, or if you're at sufficiently large rho where you trust this approximation, well, then you just get that this scalar field will roll to infinity, you decompactify space or something like that, or you go to zero string coupling, obviously in conflict with observation. Or, maybe slightly better, but still not good, is that, you know, it's negative, in which case you run away to the region where you don't trust these anymore. Okay, so this is, if you want a strong coupling region, it's a weak coupling region. Okay. So that means, well, you know, you certainly are not in a situation like this where you have like some control there. Okay. In order to get something like that,
why?
No, positive power of rho wouldn't work because the potential has to go to zero when rho goes to infinity, right? Because that's my assumption. Like we know that classically we have exactly flat directions. There's no potential. That's by definition what a modulus is. Okay. So then, well, now you say, well, okay, but of course we don't live in a classical world, so we want to include quantum corrections, but, you know, expanding around this classical point. So, for example, the volume, right, like, there will be, like, small size quantum gravity corrections, okay? So then you say, okay, let's assume the volume is very large. So then we know that whatever the correction is, it has to go to zero when the volume becomes infinitely large. Okay, so you cannot get a positive power. It must be a, yeah. But it could be, well, or even the minus rho or something. Yeah, it has to go to zero. Okay. So what we actually want is we want to stabilize at some positive cosmological constants. Right? Ridiculously small but positive. So for that you need something that potential that looks like this. Always fall up at infinity, but it must go up and then go down and go up again. Okay. And if you think about this a little, like if you try to figure out what sort of the minimal content of the potential is that you need to get something like this, then you see quickly that you need at least three corrections. Okay, giving something like V goes, say, like A over rho minus B over rho squared plus C over rho cubed, where A, B, and C are positive. Yeah. So this will dominate at large rho, so you get this positive one. This one will dominate at small rho, so you get something positive again, and then if you are lucky, and the ratio between A, B, and C is favorable, then it will go down in between again. Okay. So, in this case, stabilize or stop. Okay, so for that, you would already have to compute three corrections, okay, which may be a lot of work in general. The tree loop, derivative computation, or something like that. So that would definitely be a lot of work, but, okay, of course we're not afraid of a lot of work. However, it's a lot of work with a grim outlook, because typically, right, you will get that A, B, and C are of order one, you know, if these things come from loop corrections or maybe instanton effects or whatever. So there's no reason why one of these coefficients will be anomalously large. Okay, so AB is in suitable units, right? AB and C, order one or of the same order. Right? Let's call that order one. And then you will also typically see, indeed, that this rho star is of order one. Right. But if rho star is of order one, well, then the higher order corrections are also very important, or could also be important. Okay? So then, well, we don't know that what you've computed here makes any sense, and definitely look at large corrections. Okay, that's depressing. Yeah. On top of that, now, you know, say you do even more work, and you know you compute like a few more corrections here. Yeah, and you see, okay, well, this minimum sort of stabilizes, and then the corrections, well, it just happens to be that actually you're in a regime where you control the expansion and so on. But then you still have the problem is, you know, how could one ever get then a final value for the potential, which is the cosmological constant, which is of the order of 10 to the minus 120 in natural units. Okay. I mean, if all these things are, you know, all they are sort of given by the compactification, by the geometry, they're order one. Maybe you're lucky and there's like some skewing between them such that rho happens to be suitably large, you can control things. But then still, you know, there's not going to be some, or there's not much reason to expect some miracles such that it happens to be 10 to the minus 120 times of, like, to the fourth. Right? So how are you going to get this? So that was a big problem for many years. Still is a big problem. Yes? Can use this too, or is it all okay? Great. Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. Let's start it. So, what was the key breakthrough then? That got us in all this mess. The key breakthrough is basically fluxes. So flux modifications, which happens to be the thing I'll be talking about. But actually also, you see, I mean, fluxes, you know, people thought about them definitely before. It's not that that they're new on planet Earth. But in order for these to really lead to like successful modelized stabilization and so on, some new developments, you know, have to be done first. And so Orienti folds is basically actually one of them. Okay. And in fact also the realization that you can get like warp compactifications, like embeddings of Prandtl syndrome, so on, into string theory, which also allowed like generation of hierarchically small scales, which all contributed to the ability to control the situation. Okay. But the major thing is definitely fluxes. So, now, okay, what is a flux? So in string theory, you have all these P-form field strengths, right? Generalizing magnetic flux of ordinary gauge fields. And basically, if you turn on such fluxes in the internal manifold, then that will give rise to a classical potential. Four dimensions. Okay. So combining all these effects, once you turn on fluxes in the internal manifold, you get some potential. So F generically will denote a flux, right? This can be the maybe some gauge field flux in the internal dimensions, or this can be RR field flux, or an S field flux. That's pretty much it, right? I'll just denote this by F collectively. They're polarized entirely in internal dimensions, right? And this F star F is just the kinetic term for these fluxes, just like the electromagnetic kinetic term. Okay. But it's entirely polarized in the internal dimensions, so integrated over the internal manifold, it just gives you an energy. Like a B squared term in the dimension. Okay, I'll say in a moment. This is, and then of course there's still quantum corrections as well. Okay. So this one here, his contribution from so-called O-planes, if you don't know what that is, this will be defined so, well, later on. It's also contributions from curvature, and both of the, so curvature of the internal manifold, and both of these effectively give rise to negative energy density in four dimensions. Okay. So O-planes are negative tension objects. Curvature effectively gives you this in the relevant cases, negative energy. Well, this is not always, but in the cases where things work. And this can also come from D-brains in the compactification. Those give positive energy contributions. Okay. Now, in the absence of fluxes, yeah, then these things exactly cancel. Okay. So this is, again, a consequence of supersymmetry. There is like so-called tadpole cancellation condition saying that the total charge has to add up to zero, and by supersymmetry, that then implies that also the total energy adds up to zero. Okay, so you get various contributions to this coming from all these guys. In the absence of fluxes, it just completely cancels out. Okay. But if you turn on fluxes, it turns out that this tadpole cancellation condition gets modified, so all these guys here no longer cancel, and okay, so you get a more complicated structure. And now, well, it turns out that, you see, the star operator involves a metric, right, in the compact manifold. The metric depends on at least a geometrical moduli, this complex structure moduli, the Kähler moduli, depending on which flux is exactly turning on, or it can even be the D-brain moduli. These are world volume fluxes, okay? So these things are phi dependent. Okay, so phi is collectively modulus. All right. And usually the dependence of these different terms on phi will be different. Okay. So in the end, for a supersymmetric configuration at this classical level, it can still all cancel out, but this will put constraints on the moduli. Okay. So in other words, this will freeze at least some moduli. Okay. So I'm going to be taking notes. So this is flux. Okay, and my flux again. It's going to be RR flux, NSNS flux, world volume. Maybe well, so-called geometrical fluxes. Okay, I won't say anything about that. Right. So this B plus one. This will usually be denoted by H, flux of B fields, and this will be some F2 flux or so. Okay. Very good. Oh yeah, we can start using this. Now, of course, you cannot turn off any flux, so these fluxes have to satisfy the equations of motion internally, right? The Maxwell equations internally. But still, there is a discrete choice you can make. Okay. So they are, in fact, characterized by integer flux quanta. Ni. Okay. So this, like an Ni, would be the flux, literally, of this field F through some non-trivial cycle sigma I. If a P-form flux is a P cycle. Okay. All right. So the number of independent fluxes you can choose equals the number of homologically independent cycles of the internal manifold, right? So I goes then from 1 to the number of independent cycles in X, and so let's call that D. Okay. So again, depending on which flux you're talking about, it's a different kind of cycle, right? For in type 2B, for example, or our free-form flux, this would be the number of non-trivial tree cycles in the Calabi-Yau fault, and so on. Okay. But for the present discussion, that doesn't really matter. What that matters is that this thing is characterized by some vector in ZD, right? In some lattice, d-dimensional lattice. D can be very high, a few hundred, maybe thousands, 2,000, 3,000. Okay. Now, you cannot choose these fluxes completely arbitrarily. They're usually constrained by Tetfall cancellation constraints, because if they carry charges, and there's always a condition that the total charge has to add up to zero, because you know it's a, these things live on a compact manifold, the you know, flux line of nowhere to go if the total charge is not zero. So that gives a constraint, which is good. Otherwise, you know, people wouldn't be talking like, oh my god, that's under the 500 factor in string theory. It would be infinitely nice. Just how different that is another question, but it's definitely not it. Okay. And the Tetfall cancellation conditions, obviously, examples, but they usually take the form of some not constraint on the quadratic form of the NIs. Okay. Anyway, let me give just some toy example to illustrate the idea. Let me give it over here. Okay. So the toy example is actually not really realized anywhere in string theory, but things like that definitely are. Let's say we just have this one modulus, rho, our control modulus we had earlier. And let's say that these fluxes, together with our antipoles and all that stuff, generate some potential, which could look like this. Okay. So you see, indeed, when rho goes to infinity, this potential goes to zero. Yeah. Excuse me. Right, so it's from the general form that we were discussing earlier. But now it's clear where the minima will be. So the minima rho star appear where this becomes zero. So that's at rho star equals 1 over, so this is a sum I, AI, NI. Oh, the AI, sorry, I forgot to say, the AIs are just real numbers. Could be let's just take into these sort of set of random real numbers, maybe of order 1. In practice, they usually depend on other moduli and so on, so it becomes a very complicated couple system, but for now, let's just assume they're just given constants. Okay. So basically, what you can write is as A dot M, right, where A is an element of RD, M is an element of ZD, D is some order 100 number, maybe. Okay, and let's assume that there is also this Tetfall constraint, right, that somehow this flux is characterized by the NI, carry some charge, which looks something like this, some I and I squared, yeah, which has to be cancelled by other objects in the theory, the brains, O-planes, and so on, but the amount of those is also constrained by supersymmetry, and this then typically then gives rise to something like this, some constraint like that, where L is some positive real number. Okay, fairly large, maybe 1,000 or something. Okay, so this is sort of a cartoon of actual situations that appear. Okay, Now something interesting happens. So generically, you will have the same problem as before. Okay, for generic, so just some, if you just pick some arbitrary random n, yeah, then this will be some order one number, yeah, maybe order 1/10 or 100. But it's certainly not going to give you some parametrically large rho star. Okay, so this is just the same control problem that one has always had. But now there's something very funny going on. So when L is large, and so this is basically a variant of something that was first pointed out in writing by Bustow and Polchinski. So if L is very large, well, then the number of flux choices, if you want, so the number of different choices of assignments of n that satisfy this condition, then that is approximated by the volume of a sphere in flat space, a d-dimensional sphere of radius square root of L. Yeah, because that's what he said. Right? This is some lattice, and this bounds the flux is to be in some large sphere with radius square root of L. So you can, if this L is sufficiently large, to a very good approximation, count the number of lattice points in this sphere by just computing the volume of this sphere. And then you find that this volume is the volume of this ball is pi times L to the power d over 2 divided by d over 2 factorial. Okay. Which you can approximate by Stirling's formula, so you get 2 pi e L over d and then to the power d over 2, right? So it's a k factorial approximately. When k is very large, approximately this number. Okay. So you see that when L is large and d is large, this is exponentially large. Okay. Yeah. So if this is some number of order 10, d is some number of order 1000, this is 10 to the 5. Okay. So as a result, since there's an exponentially large number of possible choices, right, each of them will give some different value for this a dot n, right? So you get as a result you get some very finely spaced discretion of values for a dot n, out of which some will just happen to be exponentially small. Okay. So it's still a minority, but some of them definitely will just happen to, by coincidence, right, but unavoidably will give some exponentially small a dot n, and therefore rho star can become exponentially large. So that means that for those cases at least, you're in a very controlled regime. right? You get like some very large value, exponentially large value of the value of the control parameter. So you know quantum corrections or any other corrections will be exponentially small, and you have fully controlled quantification. Of course, the majority will still be non-controlled, okay? But it doesn't matter. This sort of helped them establishing, even though it makes sense, maybe establishing is a big word, but the existence of a landscape of vacuum, right? If you, at least for some values of the fluxes, can show that indeed metastable vacuum exists, right? Well, then there's no reason to assume that. Well, then it's just there. And also, okay, in fact, the total number of vacuum through which this becomes exponentially small will still be exponentially large too. Okay. Well, it's just an order of things. So, but the number of vacuum through which this becomes very, very small can still be very, very large. Okay. So, well, to round this up. So what do we have basically? Okay, so we have many fluxes, usually, but many means like a few hundred. As a result, there are exponentially many discrete choices. Yeah. So you could call them vacua if you want. So that means you get a discrete here. Let's call it a discrete here. Which means you get like a high degree of tunability, right? But without a moduli. Okay, so before you had like continuous moduli, you could tune as well, but then the whole thing got destabilized, or you get all with all these problems, right? So now you can still tune, moduli by just tuning the fluxes, but because of the direct quantization, you know, fluxes are not continuous; they're discrete things, okay? And there are no continuous moduli. Okay. So, tunability of low energy parameters but without the master scalars. So in some sense, even though, okay, this is often said that fluxes are a classical thing, in a way it's actually a quantum effect, the fact that you don't have moduli left because of direct quantization, right? So you basically what you're doing is you're trading moduli for fluxes. Classically, these fluxes could still take, you know, continuous values, so nothing would have changed. Things would just be, you know, you still have moduli, you would have flux moduli or something. But because of direct quantization, so it's a quantum effect, this cannot happen. These things are discrete. Okay. Okay. So that's an improvement to what it was before, right? You get rid of the things you don't want. I mean, from a phenomenological point of view, it's an improvement. Get rid of all the stuff you want, but still you can, you know, tune parameters to get them to agree with observation. And the most famous or infamous example of that was pointed out by Bruce Polchinski. This was a different model, but the spirit very much the same. Okay. And so they said from their model they pointed out that by this mechanism, you also resolve this third problem that I mentioned, right? That even you get lambda 0 to 10 to the minus 120 and Planck to the fourth can be achieved. With something like a few hundreds flux quanta. Yeah. Okay. And then, well, you know, the story, the reasoning goes that, well, why is the cosmological constant so small? Well, okay, it's enough that some vacuum exists with such a small cosmological constant, and that there is some mechanism by which cosmologically the set of all vacuum is sampled, for example, eternal inflation, and then anthropic post-selection, you know, just tells us that it cannot be much larger than that. So, no problem. So you may or may not like that, you know, certainly not excluded that this number will, you know, miraculously come out out of, well, God knows what. But at least it is a solution, okay? It's a logical possibility. Okay, so then I'll close this part by giving a problem, because you're supposed to get like homework problems or something like that. Unclear when you're supposed to solve all these problems, but okay. So, simple problem, I think. I hope, well, I didn't. Oh, okay. So say, for example, you consider some slight variation of what I showed before, like a toy model flux potential of this form. Okay, this is what we had before, but of course note that before the potential was so simple that solutions or that minima automatically had like a zero value of the potential. Now, this is in fact also the structure that classical type 2B flux potentials have. So the critical points are actually zeros of the potential. Again, that gets spoiled by quantum corrections, okay? But so it's not like some ridiculous case. But okay, then you can add supersymmetry breaking effects or other effects like empty brains or so on. In any case, let's just say we model that by adding this additional term here, so 1 over rho to the fourth. We satisfy our basic constraint that the potential goes to 0 at infinity. And the reason why I choose this power is to make it completely manifest that whenever you stabilize at large rho, this term will sort of be small perturbation compared to this one, okay? Suppressed by 1 over rho. So, which means you can, well, I'm going to, okay, shouldn't be solving the problem. So we still take the same that full cancellation condition. Okay, this must be less than some L. And then the question is, well, say, like, for some random A, let's, well, just for normalization purposes, let's say that the norm of A is 1. Okay. Compute how many vacua you expect. Where the cosmological constant V, right, value of this, satisfying V is, say, between 0 and epsilon, for some very small epsilon, okay, epsilon is of the same ridiculous size, say, exponentially small. Same ridiculous size as our own cosmological constant, something of that order. Okay? And this is so I. And you can assume L to be sufficiently large. That is essentially because of this. See, there's this funny fact about spheres in high-dimensional spaces. If you take the radius of the sphere constant, right, and or the radius of the ball constant, and you send the dimension to infinity, the volume of the sphere goes to zero. So you can ponder that remarkable phenomenon, which doesn't mean that the number of lattice points inside the sphere goes to zero, because if anything, if you add dimensions, it should go up, right? It just means that these approximation waves are. Okay. So you can assume this approximation holds for these purposes. Okay, questions about this general setup?
General question about these axes you're turning on. They back react on the geometry.
Yes.
Is there a kind of a,
So this is an important condition. So in type 2B compactifications, the back reaction is relatively mild in the sense that it basically just affects the warp factor. And so if the volume is large, then this effect will be relatively small. However, this is for supersymmetric solutions or the classical solutions. Now, once you start, even in type 2B, once you start breaking supersymmetry and so on, this is something you might have to worry about. But it definitely becomes a big issue in type 2A. So in particular, the scenario where in a type 2A scenario by Katsuro and DeWolf, Kiriabes. Maybe something else.
Taylor,
exactly. Thank you. So in that scenario, the back reaction of fluxes on the geometry is actually, in that case, the back reaction of the O6 plane on the geometry is even more important. So in the case that you smear the O6 over the entire compactification manifold, then you can find some complete solution, including the back reaction. It's again like basically a form of Calamity-Yau, if I remember correctly. However, with the O6, things get really bad. And so Banks and Van den Broek have tried to address this issue. And so they find, okay, it's so strong, the back reaction, according to them, completely invalidates the analysis of Katsuro et al. Then they tried, O6 are just nasty objects in type 2A in general, but if you lift them to M-theory, they become nice and smooth, like an O6 in type 2A, because they have the Hitchin manifold in M-theory. So they tried to, get to some M-theory description of this geometry to take care of this back reaction. They found they couldn't do it directly, but then they proposed some sort of a dual by some, kind of T-duality. In any case, they end up with some proposed M-theory dual, which then is the so-called Freund-Rubin compactification, the simplest example of Freund-Rubin compactification of M-theory is ADS4 times S7, but it can in general be ADS4 times any VG2 manifold source, like some positive curvature Einstein space, which is supersymmetric. And so that's a fine description. However, in that case, you find then, what the usual problem is in that kind of compactification, Freund-Rubin compactification, with all the examples that are known so far, is that it's not really a compactification in the sense that the ADS radius is of the same order as the KK radius. Okay, so there's no separation of scale, so you cannot call it a compactification. So now their analysis was somewhat inconclusive, but consistent with many other conspiracies that happen in this field. So if you really, it's in a way surprising how difficult it still is to stabilize moduli. And if you take really into account everything like back reaction, then typically get driven off to some either something that's not interesting as a complexification or to some, you know, out of the regime of control. And it didn't have to be that way, right? Because if you are careless and you make a mistake, then usually you suddenly generate, like, you know, gazillions of vacua that satisfy everything you want. That usually means you've made a mistake. So clearly there's some deeper structure, and it's probably telling us something, but at this point, you know, it's anyone's guess. But these are, yeah, these are important issues. And, but in type 2B, yeah, they are fairly well controlled. Or they're well controlled.
If you were doing some degrowth, you're reversing the tree?
Yeah. Well, oh, between from
yeah,
type 2A?
Yeah, you generate this geometric axis or something, but
yeah,
it's suddenly some different type 2A.
Oh well, it's precisely because of because T-duality fails or becomes very obscure in the presence of NSMS H flux. Okay, so so when I'm talking about, well, when I say type 2B and type 2A are very different, it's okay. Type 2B with RR and NSMS fluxes, and type 2A with RR and NSMS fluxes. Okay. So you could say, well, whatever, you know, I just start with type 2B, turn on RR and SNS boxes, everything is nicely controlled. Then I T-dualize or do mirror symmetry. But the problem is, you know, well, mirror symmetry is like doing three times T-duality. If you have H flux through over all the three directions that you T-dualize in, then you get something that's, you know, non-geometric in a very bad way. So you do it once, you get the geometric flux. You do it twice, you get something that's non-geometric, but you can still describe it geometrically by some sort of a default, or like, you know, you get some monodromies where you teach well, but you do it three times, okay? Which corresponds to doing like some T-duality where, according to all textbooks, you shouldn't be doing a T-duality, but okay. If you still do it, you get something that, yeah, doesn't even have like an approximate geometric description. So, all right, maybe you can do that, but is that a controlled construction? I don't think so. Okay. So that's where the difference comes from. Also, even if that problem hadn't been there, it's still the case that under mirror symmetry, what are quantum corrections on one side become classical on the other side. Okay, so you know, something that sort of classically works well on one side doesn't necessarily work classically well on the other side. So, more questions? So this is all very general and toy modelish. But since you're here to learn something, let's get a little bit more concrete. And also, I'll start moving to that side of the blackboard again, because I see people getting like really getting that part over there. So two is some explicit models. The structure of this part will be first explain how you can construct Calabi-Yau manifolds, and I will go beyond when, you know, the typical constructions are like toroidal orbifolds, or maybe at most a quintic or something. But of course, this is a very, very limited set, and I'll explain how you can go beyond that. And it's not so hard. You can easily learn how to do it yourself. So that will be the first part, construction of Calabi-Yaus. Second part will be how you construct orientifolds explicitly. Okay, orientifolds that, well, maybe their F theory lifts, but then I will not get into detail about C, with the introduction of flux and how they stabilize moduli. And D, well, it will turn out that flux is only stabilized part of the moduli. In the, maybe the, well, shape moduli, if you want. The Kähler moduli turns out still have to be fixed by quantum corrections. And there have been various related scenarios proposed. One is the KKLP scenario, and then there's like some somewhat better controlled variant of that by proposed by Balasubramanian Berglund, and then further elaborated on by Conlon, Quevedo, and collaborators. So we all know the quintic in CP4, you know, just like your mother taught you, quintic in CP4. Which is like this, so it's an equation. Something like that, plus further polynomial deformations, maybe zero in CP4, which means that you divide out by the equivalence, where x1 to x5 is taken to be the same as lambda x1 to lambda x5 with lambda in c star. These are, so to whom is this familiar? Not familiar, not, who has never seen this? Okay. Okay, well, there's nothing mysterious about it, right? So CP4 is just the space C5, right? Complex numbers, so on, x5 divided out by this action here, right? So it's a complex space because of that. You also take x1 to x5 to be non-zero. And then this is just some hypersurface, some complex hypersurface inside that. Okay, so this space, five coordinates, one equivalence, so CP4 is four-dimensional. And then there's one equation in there, one complex equation, so that gives you something three complex dimensional. Okay, when I say four-dimensional, I mean four complex dimensional. Three complex dimensional. So it's a possible candidate for a string compact application. And in fact, in this case, it is a very good candidate because it is a Calabi-Yau manifold. Okay, so this is Calabi-Yau. So fine. But this one is actually not good enough for actual constructions. And it's also only one example. One more. So another set of popular examples is probably an understatement. The wild following of fans are toroidal orbitals. Which means they're just discrete portions of T6. Now T6 is just the six stories. That's okay. That doesn't even scare grandmother. But then, well, T6 itself is of course a Calabi-Yau manifold, okay? Because it's flat, okay? Certainly everything that is supersymmetric. But that certainly is not good for anything. Particularly, it would give to extended supersymmetry in four dimensions. And that's something one wants to avoid. Okay, but however, if you say, for example, quotiented by this, where this group action goes like this, so the T6, right, you imagine, is the product of T2 times another T2 times another T2, right? Take a coordinate z1, z2, z3, and you take this quotient, these identifications as follows. So you say z1, z2, z3 is equivalent to minus, is identified with minus z1, minus z2, z3, and it's also equivalent with z1, minus z2, minus z3, and then of course also by the product of these identifications, which is minus z1, z2, minus z3. Okay. Then, well, that space turns out to be still Calabi-Yau, but it's now general Calabi-Yau. Like, if you compactify, like, say, the hadronic string on it, you get n equals 1 for dimensions. If you compactify type 2 on it, you get n equals 2. But then if you orientifold that thing, something you will turn to later on, you again get n equals 1. Okay. The reason why it remains Calabi-Yau has to do with the precise choice of this discrete symmetry group. But let me not get into that. Now, okay, so this gives like a certain class of examples. The advantage is that it's very concrete. But of course, there's more to life than just toroidal orbifolds and. By now, it's just been beaten to death, and it becomes extremely boring. And so, well, your advisor might be working on this for the rest of his life, but that doesn't mean you should. So, we want some more general construction. There's also other intrinsic disadvantages of these toroidal orbifolds that prompt the need for more general examples. Now, a very concrete way to construct more general examples is toric geometry. Now, toric geometry, mentioning the word toric geometry usually has the effect of, you know, people getting like all, you know, scared and afraid and so on. But in fact, that's just an artifact of the people who actually write papers on toric geometry. And this can be done, you know, very concretely and simply. And I'll try to explain about parts of that. Unfortunately, I will not have the time to really, you know, tell you how you can basically compute everything you want in this setup. It's in a much more simple way than you might expect from the literature. But yeah, if I start to blow, that's not the perfect system. So I will not do that, but let me just tell you how you can construct Clavier manifolds in this way, and so you can sort of, you know, by the end of this lecture, you can construct your own private Clavier manifold, which maybe no man or woman has ever produced before, but can give it your name. Okay. And so the construction is basically based on how one constructs so-called toric varieties, which have very little to do with actual tori, as we physicists know tori, but anyway, that's what they're called. From a very physical construction, namely just from the gauged linear sigma model. Okay. Of which the details are not really important, but the following ingredients lead to this construction. So, okay, these gauge linear sigma models, which could, for example, be four dimensions, or maybe like 1+1 dimensions, like some string, how they appear in string theory. So, the basic ingredient of that is n chiral superfields, xi, where I goes from 1 to n. Okay, so these are just, well, yeah. Well, you can just think of this, we call this capital Xi, and yeah, complex scalar components, these kind of superfields, which we'll call little xi. Okay, so just a set of n complex scalars. Now, we take them to be charged under u1 to the s, where s is just some integer. We charge us qia, right, where a goes from 1 to s. Okay, so the way I'm presenting this is just an auxiliary construction, right? This has nothing to do with actual gauge symmetries that exist in the four-dimensional theory and so on. I mean, they have a concrete physical interpretation in string theory where, you know, these spaces, these toric varieties arise as potential target spaces of the string, and the string itself is described by the gauge linear sigma model, which then, you know, at least V, which flows in the IR to some nonlinear sigma model. But, and so there they have really this physical interpretation on the world sheet. But okay, this need not worry us, just consider this to be an auxiliary construction in physical language. Okay, that will enable us to build models. Concrete models. Okay, so if there's no superpotential in this theory, then there's only a D-term potential, and this always, well, so this is a form which is entirely dictated by the charges, right? That's always is the case with D-term potentials. So it's a sum over all the gauge groups times some coupling constants EA squared, 2, and then comes the actual D term, which is sum A XI squared minus XI A squared. Okay. So this is the potential. Now, what we're really interested in is the supersymmetric moduli space of supersymmetric configurations, which is the space of all scalar values for which the D-term potential is zero, modulo the U1 gauge equivalence. U1 to the S gauge equivalence. Okay, so supersymmetric moduli space. Basically just V equals zero mod U1 to the S. So more concretely, let's call this M. Is just all x in C to the M, for which some I, Qi, A, xi squared equals psi A. Okay, modulo U1 to the S, where, to be completely explicit, U1 to the S, yeah, by definition of these charges, U1 to the S, X on the Xi as E to the I, Qi A, Phi A, exactly. Okay, just by charge Qi. Okay, so if it happens, so if you choose your Xi A's suitably, and they're such that the resulting space here has the expected dimension, so a dimension of M equals, so this is the complex. When I talk about dimensions here, I'm already talking about complex dimensions. The complex dimension of M is N, the number of fields, minus S real constraints, minus S U1 equivalences, so it's minus 2S real variables, so it's minus S complex. Okay, so the expected dimension is N minus S. If that's the case, modulo maybe some potential solubility, but then M is the toric variety. Okay, as simple as that. Let me give you an example. Let me give you three examples, in fact, which will be relevant for us later. Well, one will be irrelevant, one will be this. The second one will be relevant in that they will provide us with a botched attempt at constructing some explicit model with stabilized moduli. And a third one will eventually give rise to a very concrete, actual, explicit realization of A to B flux vacuum with all moduli stabilized. So, example one. Example one is just the construction of CP4. How do we do that? Well, just take five scalar fields and one U1, so we take n equals 5, s equals 1, and we give the fields the following charges, so x1, x2, x3, x4, x5, charge 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. They all get charged 1. Okay. So the resulting space, the vacuum manifold, I mean, the vacuum of this gauge linear signal model, is, okay, just this. So it's a space of all x in Cn, for which some I xi squared equals psi, and they're divided by U1, where U1 is just simultaneous phase rotation of all the xi's. Yeah? Okay, well, if xi is less than 0, then this is just the empty sets. It's not particularly interesting. However, if xi is greater than 0, indeed, this space is CD4. Why is that? Well, how does it relate to this construction? Well, you see, the difference between this equivalence and the U1 equivalence is the scale factor, right? So C star you can take to be U1 times just R plus, right, which are just the positive scale transformations of the coordinates, okay? And here you also have this additional constraint. Now, you can just consider this constraint to be just the gauge fixing of the scale transformations here, okay? So the phase part of the scale transformations is just U1. The scale part of these transformations, of these gauge transformations, if you want, is fixed by this constraint. With one exception, namely, when x equals 0, okay, then no matter how you scale and scale and scale, it remains 0, so you can never satisfy this. Okay, so to get these two to agree, you have to remove 0 here. Okay. Very good. Now, moreover, you see this xi here as the role of a size modulus, right? You see, you know, this is some compact space, you know, it's sort of like a sphere, whatever. Well, I think it's quite a sphere, but you see, if xi goes up, xi is something like the radius. Right? So if this goes up, then the size of the space goes up. And you can make it very precise. This is really, really the actual size of a particular two-cycle that exists in this geometry, holomorphic two-cycle. But I don't know, have the time to make it precise, but it can be done very quickly. So this is what eventually will be called the Kähler modulus of this moment.
Does example 1 as regional homologous the number of curves
Yeah, but so we will not. That's right. That's right. So if you have an actual right, but you could, well, okay. One way to get around that is like to say, okay, well, I'm just looking at quantum mechanics, like just quantum mechanics in the target space, because there you don't get anomalies. But as I was stressing, we will just. I mean, this is just like. If you want, it's a mathematical construction, but I'm just using physical language to make it. As a physical theory, yeah, but not as a mathematical geometrical construction, okay, and not if it's a 0 plus 1 dimensional, if it's a 1 dimensional QFD, if it's quantum mechanics, it's not inconsistent or 0 dimensional, if you want. But you're right, yeah. So there's in general there. Because you can, and the way to deal with that and actually have like a consistent sigma model with this target space is you add one coordinate with a particular weight and you add a superpotential. And
the other way, the simplest way is to work a joint representation.
A joint representation?
Yeah, where you don't have that problem.
Oh, okay. All right. Great. Okay. Now, second example is only a slight variation of this, but it will come back later in an actual construction. So this is weighted projective space of dimension 4 with weights 1, 1, 1, 4. Okay, what does this mean? It just means this. So again, we take 5 fields. Okay. Charge Q, 1, 1, 1, 1, 4. Okay. So now M is given by, you know, some I 1 to 4 xi squared plus 4 x5 squared equals xi, which is equal to 0. Same story. So in fact, this space, as you can check for yourself, has a Z4 orbifold singularity. So that, when that occurs, you sometimes have to be a little bit careful. And try to blow it up. And then finally, example 3, which will give an intermediate step to some model that actually, you know, will be successful in stabilizing all of the moduli, everything. I don't know if it has a particular name. I don't think so. So let's just call it PI1. To exist on this glorious day. And, well, it has just charged assignments for 5, 6. Well, so now we take, in fact, n equals 6, the 2 u1s, OK? again, it gives a four-dimensional space. And the reason why I have, like, I exhibit this obsession with four-dimensional toric varieties is not because that's the only dimension in which you can construct them, obviously, but because, well, all these spaces are not quite Calabi-Yau, and in fact, it will turn out that it's impossible to get a compact toric variety to be Calabi-Yau, but hypersurfaces in them, just given by one equation. Can be Calabi-Yau, and I will use these spaces I introduce here now in a few minutes to actually construct actual Calabi-Yau manifolds in those spaces of one dimensional lower, which is three dimensional, which is exactly the dimension of Calabi-Yau manifolds, which we need in type 2 string theory to get down to the four dimensions we all know and love. So that's the reason. Okay, and so this one is a little bit more involved. Okay, but still. Okay. All right, well, these are the changes. Yeah. Furthermore, geometrically inclined, you can see that this is actually a CP1 bundle over CP2. No, over CP3. But that needs not concern us. Okay. Now, no, I didn't. Sorry, I'm talking. This is not. If this hadn't been there, this would be the case. This is something else. This is why I've called it here. Yeah, because I don't know what it is, but it works. Yeah. Okay. Good. So you can probably write down the equations for it yourself. Right? It's x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared minus x4 squared plus 2x6 squared equals psi1, and x4 squared plus x5 squared plus x2x6 squared equals psi2. And then you take psi1 and psi2 positive, I think, and get something. So in this case, no, there's two psi's. So there's two psi's moduli. Yeah. So there will be two Kähler moduli in this example. So just two psi's. OK. Now, I'm really interested in, as I said, constructing Calabi-Yau manifolds. So one is a toric variety Calabi-Yau. Well, there's a simple rule. It's Calabi-Yau, which means it has a C3 holonomy, which means first churn class is 0, which means it admits a Ricci flat metric, which means it admits a unique, nowhere vanishing, holomorphic free form. There's many definitions, which means, you know, which means it's you know, what we want. And Well, the condition is very simple. The sum of all the charges has to be zero for all U1s. So it's not the case here, as you can see, it's not the case here, it's not the case here. It would be the case, for example, for, say, so if you take charge, if you take four fields, one, 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 let's say five minus three. Sorry. And then three here. But to construct a threefold, sorry. Okay, they sum up to zero, but as you can check for yourself, this defines a non-compact space, basically because X4 can grow together with X1 to the parameter. Okay, so it's always like that. Always non-compact. Okay. So we need to just one little step up. In complexity, and as I said earlier, so just do it in the last 5 minutes. It's by considering hypersurfaces, which just means things given by one complex equation, or, well, you could extend this to many complex equations, which are then called complete intersections, probably because just saying intersections didn't sound sophisticated enough, so they called complete intersections. In toric varieties. Okay. So a hypersurface in a toric variety is given by one equation, and it would be just one polynomial equation. Okay, now in order for this to make sense in a toric variety, the polynomial has to be homogeneous. Okay. So what does it mean, homogeneous? It means that all the terms have the same charge. Okay. All terms same charge. Okay, so all the monomials are combinations of the x's, of the x fields, so they will all have a particular charge. In order for this to be a well-defined equation on currently M, the equation has to be Gaussian. Well, the equation has to be Gaussian invariant, so all the terms have the same charge. And then this will define a nice complex four-dimensional one hypersurface. And then the condition for this to be Calabi-Yau. So I will just first state the general conditions, and then I'll give you the three examples. Well, hypersurfaces in these three examples, which are Calabi-Yau. So S will be a Calabi-Yau manifold, even only if the charges of this polynomial X is the same as the sum of the charges of all fields. Simple as that. Okay, I'll give an example in a minute, but it just charge has to be equal to the sum of the charges of the defining fields. Okay, and you can extend this to this intersection, so you can define S. This is another hypersurface, of course, as something that satisfies P1x equals 0, and it also satisfies P2 x equals 0, and so on, to some p, k, x equals 0. OK, so you can think of it as the intersection of k hypersurfaces, which will give you a complex four-dimensional k thing, so n minus s minus k dimensional thing, whatever. OK, so a nice complex variety. Well, it may be singular, but anyway, complex. This thing is Calabi-Yau, even only if the sum over all polynomials of Q P alpha of X is equal to the sum of all charges. Okay. So in summary, when you have a Calabi-Yau defined in this way, you just need that the total charge of the equations equals the total charge of the fields, if you want. The sum of the charges of all the equations has to be equal to the sum of the charges of all fields. Okay. So now you can just start generating Calabi-Yau as many as you want. I set your own private one. But let me give you. Three simple examples inside of the three examples of toric varieties that I gave. Okay. So one is again the quintic in CP4. Okay. Indeed. Right, so it's just some fifth order homogeneous polynomial equation in the x's. For example, x1 to the fifth plus x2 to the fifth, x3 to the fifth, plus x5 to the fifth equals 0. Okay. So you check charge of the equation fifth order, so it's 5. And the sum of the charges of the cube of the fields, 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, 5 is 5. So it's Calabi-Yau, indeed. Okay, now in 2, you could, for example, look to an equation like this. And so as I said, again, this will be of some physical relevance, so remember it well. X5 squared equals some degree 8 homogeneous polynomial H of X1 to X4. Okay? So, for example, this could be some I 1 to 4 X5 to the 8 plus maybe X1 squared plus X2 squared times this plus X1 to the 7 X2 and so on. With coefficients. Well, anyway, I don't have to explain to them. Eighth order homogeneous polynomial is something like that. Okay, so with this thing, you find the charge of the equation is what? Well, it's twice. Oh, yeah, and note also that this makes sense, right? See, the charge of left-hand side must be equal to the charge of the right-hand side. Charge of the right-hand side is 8, right? Left-hand side is also 8, because here, this guy here has charge 4. 4 times 2 is 8. Okay, the charge of the equation is therefore 8. And the total charge of all fields, 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 4, is 8. Okay? Okay, so this is Calabi-Yau. And this will be able to orient it later. And then finally, the third example, which will be a and reality folds in which all moduli can be stabilized. Okay. For example, 3, which will, as you will see, will, well, it looks suspiciously like example 1 formally. It's 1, 2, x, 5. Okay. So now, do I have this guy? This is a well-defined equation. So now there's 2 charges. Okay. So I have to make sure that this makes sense as an equation for the 2 charges, so that all terms are the same. So I take x6 squared, which is charge 4, 4. Yeah. And therefore, whatever the polynomial here in the other variables, x1 to x5, is, it has to have charge 4, 4, too. Okay, so then you can start puzzling. Okay, so like, for example, you could take maybe x1 to the, let's say x1 to the fifth times, x1 to the fourth, there's a lame example is x1 to the fourth, x5 to the fourth. Okay, there's clearly many other terms. Yeah? Okay. So, and again, you can check. Okay, so this is in our PI1. So we can pull this. Yeah, okay. And again, you see Q of the equation is 4, 4. And some I, QI is also 4, 4. So therefore, this thing is clearly out. Call it CIPI1. Okay. Okay. Of course, I have designed everything such that all these things worked out fine. So let me end by giving you a last problem. And by the way, So let's take an arbitrary toric variety. Yeah. So build out of the scalars xi, is 1, 2, n. The charges, as usual, we call QIA. Okay. So then, the idea is now we're going to add one extra field. So you start with an arbitrary one. Okay. So you add one extra field. And now the question is, find the correct charge assignment. So what does the charge, what charge does this extra field for extra field? So this xn plus 1 extra field, you add a new field, such that let me continue here. Just that equation. So the equation of the form x n plus 1 squared equals some suitable h x1 xn. Okay, so generalizing the form of the equations that we had before. Okay, where h, of course, has to have some suitable charge, suitable weights, such that this equation makes sense. It's compatible with whatever you choose, your charge assignments. So such that this defines a Calabi-Yamani. Okay? And you'll see that a unique charge assignment that does it. So what does this mean? It means you can take any toric variety at one coordinate, give it a suitable charge assignment, you can write an equation of this form, it will give you a Calabi-Yamani. Okay. The one catch is that it may be singular, so if you require regularity, that tends to make the number of possibilities finite. But in any case, this gives you a huge class of Calabi-Yamanis, which, as you will see, you can then easily orientally fold. You can explicitly describe the D7 brains and all this stuff in there. You could even compute various geometric constraints for instanton contributions. You can compute with a little bit more of effort the number of flux factor and all that, that you can really completely establish or analyze whether this is a vacuum in which we could live. So you can just write a group somewhere, maybe you find B through Calabi-Yamani arguments. Okay, and that's how much time. Good.